Join R. Paul Martin and Pickles of the North on Back of the Book, alternate Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. We'll talk about science, politics, and details of our little lives.
You're a thought criminal.
You betcha.
That's Back of the Book, alternate Saturday mornings at 5 a.m.
Freeform live radio in the dwindling darkness. Only here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
And you're indeed tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And, stalling for 7 seconds. Well, 6 seconds early. But, hey, let's howl. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, an interview with Lucius Shepherd from a few years back. Lucius passed away last week. Also, Dan Persons reviews Divergent after the theme.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Okay, let's see if we can follow the premise of Divergent. 100 years after the war. What war? They don't say. Maybe it's the Cola Wars. Pepsi won, but oh, what a cost. 100 years after this oddly nonspecific war, the remainder of humanity, or maybe just the United States, or maybe just Chicago, once again they're not saying, our survivors in question have managed to attain a kind of stability by dividing humanity into 5 factions. There's the Amity, who are the farmers, the Dauntless, who are the soldiers and the police force, the Erudite, who are the brainy guys, the Abnegation, who are selfless, and also because of that form the government, and the Candor, who are compulsively honest and thus become the judicial and the lawyers. And if that were really so, Shakespeare wouldn't have had any case against them. So when the kids here hit age 16, all the teenagers undergo a test where they get drugged and a computer reads their minds, determining to which faction they'll belong for the rest of their lives. Unless they want to go into another faction, which they're free to do. But if they then discover that they're not suited to that other faction, which the test told them they weren't anyway, remember? It's too late. They can't go back to the faction they were pegged for, nor can they try another faction. They become factionless, outcasts, because in a world where humanity is on the ropes, this is a sensible use of manpower. There is another possibility. You can be diagnosed as having the traits of several factions. You would think that would be a valuable person to have around, and that such a person would be treasured and fought over by the various factions. But no, these people are called Divergent and are feared and despised because, I don't know, because nobody likes a show-off? Look, Divergent is produced by Summit, the people who did the Twilight Saga films, and they pretty much know their mostly teen, mostly female market. As a metaphor, Divergent strikes at the heart of an audience looking uneasily at an impending adulthood and concerned about the pressure of locking themselves in for a future that they themselves aren't sure they want. And it isn't as if the metaphor couldn't work in film, but it takes someone with the verve, the style, and, frankly, the audacity of a Terry Gilliam, a Tim Burton, a Rod Serling even, to make this work in a way that the setup doesn't trip the "oh come on" censors every 5 minutes. Divergent is directed by Neil Berger, who a while ago did a very interesting mockumentary/thriller called Interview with the Assassin, and followed up with a flawed but also interesting quasi-fantasy/drama The Illusionist that got overshadowed by Chris Nolan's similar and also flawed The Prestige. In telling the tale of a young woman who tries to hide her divergence by leaving the family business of abnegation and deciding to run with the cool kids of Dauntless, in the process discovering a deadly conspiracy in the works, Berger is trying for a Hunger Games vibe, but between the wan performance of lead actor Shailene Woodley, a mise-en-scene that doesn't really push the hyperbole far enough to sell the metaphor, and an anti-intellectual outlook that has the brainy erudite as the mustache-twirling villains, using science as a simultaneously all-powerful yet weirdly imprecise cudgel, this doesn't really rise above the pedestrian norm. There's some interesting imagery during the hallucinogenic testing sequences, and if you love watching healthy, muscular young men and women climbing things and leaping on and off trains, that seems to be the Dauntless's main occupation, you get your fill here. Otherwise, at 2 hours and 20 minutes, Divergent is a real slog. I'm Dan Persons. If you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out Cinefantastique online over at cfqonline.com.
Okay, well, one note to all of you, because I know everybody says it that way. Erudite? No. Erudite is a mischievous pronunciation. If you don't want to be mischievous, say erudite, or add an I in that word. There's only an I near the end. It's erudite, and erudite has become de rigueur, the way that mischievous was some years ago. But fortunately, mischievous is sort of like passing out of the language, but erudite, alas, is very much in vogue. But this is Erudite, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio for the moment, WBAI, at 99.5 FM, and my name's Jim Freund. This program is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor, brought to you over these airwaves since 1972. And one of our friends, Lucius Shepard, died last week. He was 71 years old. He was a brilliant writer. He basically followed his own drumbeat, as you will hear in the interview that we are about to hear. Looking him up on Wikipedia, they say, classified as a science fiction and fantasy writer, he often leaned into other genres such as magical realism. And I have a problem with the idea that magical realism is not science fiction or fantasy. Of course it is. It is a description of stuff within SF. But his work is infused with a political and historical sensibility and awareness of literary antecedents. And I say, yeah, that's correct, except for the fact that he himself has become a literary antecedent. He did not begin writing genre fiction or any kind of fiction, really, until he was 40 years old. But in the 30 years following, he has been remarkable in turning out some brilliant, brilliant books and stories of all different lengths, novels and novellas, short stories of many types, even a couple of nonfiction books. And he was the regular film critic for a number of years for the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. And I have to say that I really looked out for that stuff. I remember during one of his visits to New York, I asked him what to look out for, and he told me to check out this upcoming movie called Gattaca by a first-time director and writer named Andrew Niccol, N-I-C-C-O-L, who had previously written the screenplay for The Truman Show, but was given The Truman Show sort of with the understanding that he could make his own movie. Gattaca came out first, and then Peter Weir directed The Truman Show. And he had two brilliant films in a row, something that he, alas, did not come up to. But I'm just saying this as an indicator of how well Lucius seemed to understand what was going on, and more so, I'm not quite sure how he had an ear to the ground, that he knew about these films that had not yet been reviewed, they had not yet been screened, but he had his ear to the industry better than, you know, say, the Hollywood, as well as the Hollywood Reporter or Variety or whatever. And I read those same publications. I do. At least Hollywood Reporter more so than Variety. And they review films 3 weeks before they open and tell you about them going into production, stuff like that. I enjoy looking at their website and getting all of that information in emails. But Lucius's information was even more appealing. His short stories, I mean, his novels are quite something. Green Eyes, I'm just looking at Wikipedia through his various titles. They put his novels and novellas together, which is all right, I suppose, because they are, in each case, longer works, although not necessarily separately bound works. But for me, the best of his work would be found in The Jaguar Hunter, which was his first collection of short stories, originally published in 1987. Then, 10 years later, Barnacle Bill the Spacer and other stories. And I was a big, big fan of his short work, and I certainly enjoyed the longer work. But most importantly, I enjoyed Lucius. I liked him a great deal. One time he was in New York City. I am not sure of the exact year. He was going to be doing Hour of the Wolf on the Saturday morning, live. And he had health issues. He was not able to make it to the studio and, in fact, had been hospitalized en route with something that, you know, I suspect is related to the stroke that he finally succumbed to last week. But that's only speculation on my part. But having missed the program several days later, he came to my house in Brooklyn and we recorded an interview, which was interrupted several times by his phone ringing and various things. I have done my best to edit those out and to create continuity. I have taken a break in the center where we'll play a cut of music. And we'll reintroduce the program. But outside of that, you're hearing that hour, alas, not a reading within it. He did several readings that I have on recording, but they are mostly not broadcastable because, like Barnacle Bill, the sailor, or the spacer, he got a mouth on him, one that the FCC does not necessarily approve of. But I am guessing from certain clues he makes reference to a movie called The Host, an Asian film. I think it's Korean at the time. And we say right at the outset that this is on December 4th, but what year? I am going to guess that this is 2007 or 2008. And he and I did two interviews together. This is the latter of the two. And certainly has not been broadcast since then. And I'm sorry that it has taken his passing. to bring his voice back on the air. But on the other hand, I'm pleased to be able to present this to you. So without further introduction, because there's a lot of autobiographical information, a lot of talking about a lot of subjects in here, set your way back machine to December 4th of an unknown year and listen to an interview with Lucius Shepard.
Today is, what, December 4th at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Brooklyn, and I am with Lucius Shepard. We were going to do a live show, but fate intervened.
Right.
But fortunately, we were able to eck out the time, and I mean eck out the time. Lucius doesn't get to New York that often, once a year or so.
Yeah.
And when you get here, you're busy.
Yeah. You know, I'm busy, you know, so, you know.
But that's, yeah. Like I say, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
What is it, well, I've already, in the future, which will, by this recording, have been the past, I'll already have told people all about you. But you are, what are the terms that people call you that you don't like as a writer?
That I don't like?
Yeah. I mean, for example, do you embrace the term a writer of magical realism?
No. I don't dislike any terms. I mean, you know, when people can call me what they want, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have any effect on me as long as I don't hear it. And when I do hear it, you know, usually I'm not in their company, so it's like, you know, I don't tend to object too much, you know, anyway. But
although at the time of this recording, it's in the first sentence of what people would see as, say, Wikipedia, which,
right,
of course, we can change by tomorrow.
Wikipedia. Wikipedia is about, it sounds a lot like what it is, its name, Wikipedia. That doesn't sound like an authority.
No.
You know, like,
it's a resource. It's not, right, an authority.
No, I mean, I've written some stuff which loosely could be called magical realism. I mean, I write fantasy. I write mainstream. I write whenever the mood suits, you know. I mean, just whenever it happens to be, you know. Like, I don't try and aim my stuff into any direction or any particular slot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, right now I'm writing several mainstream stories and a long kind of blue-collar fantasy and a novel that's really a mainstream novel but will be marketed as a genre novel, I'm sure,
mm-hmm,
which is a vampire novel with no vampires.
Okay.
You know, and so it's, you know, a novel about a family called the Piercefields, who came over to the United States in the late 1600s and settled in South Carolina. And along about the 1850s, you know, the patriarch of the family decided that he could see which way the wind was blowing, you know, politically, kind of, and he knew that the South was going to lose the war that was coming, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started spreading rumors around the area that his family was supernaturally gifted. In other words, that they were vampires.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, this was in order to help them hold on to their land holdings when the invasion came, when the Yankees came down from the north, you know. It would perhaps give them a buffer, you know, and, like, you know, so he spread all these rumors about it, and they did manage to hold on to their considerable holdings in South Carolina and became, in the modern day, a powerful political family. And since then, they've made a game out of being vampires. They, you know, have this, you know, immense, intricate history of the family as vampires. They've developed this etymology of vampirism, you know, which is, you know, really complex. They've, you know, they have their house tricked up. They have mirrors that don't give reflections. They have all these little deceptive things. Now, the point is, they may in fact be vampires, or, well, the novel starts with a murder, mm-hmm. and it's done in the manner of a vampire murder, you know. And like, so either someone is trying to set them up, they are vampires, or a vampire has infiltrated them. You know, and so, you know, I think it's a mainstream novel, but perhaps I'm wrong.
You know? Yeah, but that's the best kind. Isn't
yeah,
it?
Right.
Yeah.
My best work tends to be ambiguous.
Yeah. Is it ambiguous to you, the way you're talking about it? It's as an...
Well,
you're using an ambiguous mindset to help create that for the book itself.
Well, you know, I haven't finished the book yet, and so, I mean, you know, it's like... you know, perhaps I'm going to go one way or the other, but I tend to think I'm going to leave it in the mind of the reader as much as possible, you mm-hmm. know, like, you know, and let them decide, you know, so. Yeah.
And, of course, the marketing people will probably be the final arbiter.
And they'll put big teeth on the front, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know. Yeah, and then the...
And then all the people who read it, her vampire fans, will be really...
pissed off.
Yeah. Like so, you know. But there's, you know, there's enough vampire-like bloodshed in the book, you know, to
satisfy them.
To cause doubt, you know. So, you know, yeah, and to satisfy, you know. But anyway, yeah.
So, yeah, I should mention that we are recording this in the palatial abode in which I live. So we're just being at home here.
Right.
If you hear phones going off, printers, it's just part of a Tuesday afternoon
right.
in Brooklyn. So blue-collar Brooklyn, I should mention.
Right. I got that.
Oh, yeah, very much, very much. The labeling thing is something that has always been a problem for genre writers
yeah.
through years. I mean, that's, half of what makes the genre is the label.
Yeah.
How do you does that make it a good game for you? Is it a bad thing? Is it?
I really don't know. I mean, you know, like I mean, it. It may be a bad thing, and some people have said my stuff has mainstream, it has a mainstream feel anyway, you know, and like, I imagine.
Not sure what that means, but okay.
Well, I mean, in other words, it has like.
You write good prose.
Yeah, well, it has a complexity and an emphasis on character more than plot.
Right.
You know, and like, so, I mean, in that sense, it's less genre than others, but I mean, I've written some stuff that's straight genre. I mean, you know, like, so I mean, I don't really care. I mean, I try to write what the story demands, you know, and like, if it's a genre story, it's a genre story. As far as the labeling goes, I mean, I think that's all going to go away. I mean, you know, like, maybe not in my lifetime, but like, certainly, you know, you're having all these people write science fiction novels or mainstream writers now, and you know, and it's like you're having Michael Chabon have with his success, but you know, I think that's that whole genre label for those who don't wish to have it is going to be kind of an item of like, you know, the past, a relic of the past. I mean, you know, if you don't want to be known as a genre writer, eventually you won't be. If there is reading, if reading goes on,
yeah,
I don't really think that's going to be much of a problem for future writers to come, you know, because they're going to be the beneficiary of this day and age in which, you know, all the genres are blending together and, you know, mainstream is this. And you're having guys write about golems and stuff like that in mainstream fiction. You're having, you know, guys like DeLillo write science fiction novels and stuff. I mean, eventually I think it's all going to be just stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, you know, basically.
I think they'll be both good and bad.
Yeah, I mean, being a genre writer has its benefits. I mean, you know, like, I mean, it does help as a marketing tool, you know. Like, yeah. You know, but, you know. But, again, if they call it a mainstream book and they put a big pair of fangs on the cover, I mean, what the heck?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, so, I mean, you know.
But it is true that when I go to a bookstore, I will go to the various genres in which I am interested in. And in the mainstream section, I don't know, am I looking for romance, Civil War,
right.
whatever. It's too broad. So I like the idea of a certain amount of labeling as long as it doesn't involve pigeonholing.
Well, in my case, like in back in Portland where I live, like they have my books in the mainstream section and in the science fiction section. So, you know.
Yeah, that's the best way. Yeah. And as online sales continue,
yeah.
And if they ever figure out how to use those tags, which
right.
they really don't get,
right.
they use them, but that's just Web 2.0. I'm very down on Web 2.0.
Yeah.
which brings up a question you had mentioned. If people continue to read, have you doubts?
Oh, sure. You know, but, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, I think, you know, I think we're seeing a tremendous dumbing down of the culture. I mean, you know, and basically, I think it's almost, I'm almost a conspiracy. It's been a marketing strategy for a long time to, you know, to dumb down the culture and make it like, you know, just make everything accessible, you know, one size fits all, one age, you know, like, I mean, they say for children of all ages, well, I mean, you know, that's pretty much a category in itself, you know, and I think that's pretty much, you look at the audience for movies these days, I mean, you know, I mean, a great number of movies come from graphic novels and from children's books and from things, and I think that there's a reason for that. I think that people are just not, you know, they're not into being challenged in the theaters anymore, you know. Like, I mean, you see films, a film like Chinatown, for instance, which was a very good film, couldn't get made today. I mean, it just couldn't get made. You could pitch that in the studio.
But Chinatown, I almost didn't get made then, did it? I mean,
well, no, but I mean,
it didn't have Robert Towne and Roman Polanski.
Right, but I mean, it did get made. But now, I mean, it would take a lot, you know. I mean, to to get a film like that made, you know, like, mm-hmm. I mean, you would, you know, almost be, you know, it would be a fool's errand. I mean, the guys would say, I mean, well, as an example, Russell Banks is the mainstream novelist. He's a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
He was pitching his novel, Continental Drift, you know, and out in Hollywood,
and he
went to see went to meet this producer, and the producer had read the book, apparently. And, like, he said, no, let me get this straight. This is about a plumber, right? And Russell said, yeah. And he said, well, it's about a plumber who helps all these poor people get into the States. And he says, yeah. And the producer says, well, why should I care? You know, and that's the kind of thing you're met with, you know. Like, I mean, so you if your plumber is a superhero or a spy or something like that, I mean, you know, you might get away with it, but just a plumber who's having problems with his marriage and, you know, flips out and goes to Miami and starts smuggling Haitians into the country, I mean, no, that's not a good story. You know?
And yet there's still independent media. A movie like Waitress got made and got recognized.
Well, Waitress got made and recognized, I mean, and it could probably basically boosted its circulation because the writer got murdered.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, you know, but like so many indie films and even indie or foreign genre films, even, you know, like which in my view are vastly superior to the Hollywood product or the indie product over here, like just died mortal death. Like The Host was mm-hmm. was a recent was probably the best monster movie I've ever seen, you know, like, and it didn't do anything over here, really. I mean, it did no business, you know. And like,
yeah, it got relegated to cable pretty quickly.
Yeah,
with 2 stars on.
Yeah,
out of 4,
which is
yeah.
ridiculous because it's a fantastic movie, and like, but people didn't understand they didn't quite grok the kind of Korean humor, you know, and stuff. But it was a wonderful movie, a wonderful monster movie, and with a great monster.
WBAI New York.
all the stuff. And like, it was a very layered story, a family. It was a dysfunctional family story and a comedy, you know, a satire on modern Korean culture and a horror movie at the same time, you know. But, you know, it was too complex for audiences here. They're going to remake that now, and you watch. They'll take out every bit of subtext. Hollywood's going to remake it, every bit of subtext, and it'll end up with Josh Hartnett saving the world. You know?
That's what happened to The Vanishing.
Yeah.
That's
the same director.
Yeah. It's the same director, the same guy.
And Night Watch, the same thing. The movie Night Watch, which was not the Russian movie, but I think it's a Dutch movie, the old one with Nick Nolte and
Ewan McGregor. I don't know that one.
That was the same director as well, and totally dumbed down, you know. Like, but you know, they have a tendency to bring over. I mean, Oliver Hirschbiegel was brought over to do a new version of the Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah,
a German director, which was, which they said, well, we want to have it something different, you know, and like. And then he turned it in. And he says, "Well, we didn't know it would be that different." You know, like, and so they reshot the ending, and then they said, "Well, they brought in another guy," and he said, "No, let's do this." So they reshot 2/3 of the movie, and they ended up with this absolute, you know, banal hybrid movie, which is just, you know, awful.
Yeah, if they can get the whole thing into a DVD at the end, so that that'll be interesting to see. How many different films you can make out of it?
Oh yeah, no, that'll be amusing. I don't know if they'll do it, but like if they,
of course they won't. But
they
tried it once with Once Upon a Time in the West before DVDs at Film Forum here in New York, mm-hmm. which is an art cinema. They showed like 8 versions. It took 2 days to show all the different cuts.
Yeah, that'll be. But anyway, you know, I mean, the idea being is like it seems to me they're trying to make the entertainment media like just generally this bland, accessible entry into, you know.
But aren't books the exception to that?
Are they really? I mean, here you got franchise books are dominating. First of all,
well, they're dominating the big market, yes. Yeah. But you're not doing franchise books, and most of the people on my show, with the exception of a very few people, that's not what they're doing either. And yet they are being celebrated, and small presses are rising, and
small
new
press.
Kelly links emerge every so often.
Yeah, the small press is like, you know, kind of a, I mean, everybody talks it's a golden age of the small press. I mean, I don't know. I mean, they throw that term golden age around a lot. There are always small presses. There are always, small presses always have their heyday, their prime.
Yeah.
And but they always tube, you know. Like I mean, you know, like
yeah.
I mean, you know, like
it's cyclic.
Yeah, and like so. I mean, I don't know if this is a golden age or not, but like.
I don't know if that's golden age or not. And of course, there's the whole publishing on demand, which I think is a danger to dumbing down because it means that you're removing publishers and editors. Often from the mix, and vanity presses abound, and the web isn't helping that much.
But the thing is, like, I mean, for all its virtues and liabilities, a book like a Harry Potter book, you know, is basically, you know, people want more of that, you know, though they're being taught to want more of that and, like, look less in the cracks and nicks and crannies. And like,
But I would say that once upon a time, science fiction was Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers.
Right.
And people wanted more of that. And
that's true,
And then it was Star Trek.
Well, you
people didn't want more of 2001. Mm-hmm. They wanted more of Star Trek. They wanted more of Star Wars and Battlestar Galactica, the old Battlestar Galactica.
Right, right.
And yet, somehow, it helped nourish the real stuff. The fact that you had this huge, amorphous, banal piece of junk out there.
Yeah. I mean, basically, I mean, the short fiction has been like kind of a lifeblood of science fiction. And with the death of the genre magazines, impending death of the digest magazines and things like that, like, I mean, their circulation is dropping yearly. And, like, I mean, that's going to be a tremendous blow, you know, if it ever... you know, they ever finish, you know,
yeah.
that process. And like, and I mean, most
that would be a tremendous blow because it was bad enough losing the pulps.
And now you've lost like Datlow's sci-fi, you know, and like instead it's been replaced by, I mean,
sci-fiction. Yeah,
it's been replaced by. Well, Bain has a high-paying fiction site and stuff right. like that, and, but they want plot-driven stories, and they, you know.
Well, they still, I don't think they still know how to make money on the web. Frankly, they don't get it, and I don't know if they ever will get it. And
I'm not sure I do.
for a good reason. It may not be the place to publish. I, for one, don't like reading on a screen. Start with that premise. Yeah. Now, on the other hand, I see the web as a distribution medium, perhaps, and a way to get books come out of machine in my house.
Like Cory Doctorow did. It's a way of build careers, too.
Exactly.
Right? You know, like, I mean, but...
Yeah, he gets it. Yeah. He understands that.
Right.
And he has been able to use the web as a distribution tool.
Right.
I don't think too many people are reading Eastern Standard Time. Is that the name?
Yeah, Eastern Standard.
I don't think they're reading a Cory Doctorow book on their computer screen, or even necessarily on...
No, but they're just getting a taste for it, and then they say, well, I'll get something I can carry around.
Now, there might be the Sony Book Reader or the Amazon...
You know, those things have never taken off, though. I mean, you know, like, I mean, I thought the e-books were really gonna explode, you know, and, like, you know, they didn't, and, like, so...
Yet. I mean, those things take time. What I do write about and deal with is technology.
Yeah.
And I remember when Apple created the PDA, the Newton, which was a horrible piece of technology.
Right.
But it was the first of its kind. And it took about 15 years for the smartphone and for PDAs to take hold. And when Apple finally reinvented that wheel, they came up with something that's not as good as a PDA. It's a superphone, the iPhone. It's
right.
So astonishingly, they dumbed it down. But everybody's walking around with one. Sometimes these things take time. The new ebook readers, the ones with so-called digital ink, there's only two of them. Mm-hmm. There's the Sony, and now there's one from Amazon.
Yeah,
and I don't think either of them are going to be the ultimate toys. But I do think in 15 years, people will be reading off of a device like that.
That would be good.
What's sad is that we won't have. I enjoy the clutter of my house.
Yeah, I like books. You know, yeah, I like them lying around.
But whatever happens, I don't think people will stop reading.
Yeah, I like writing on the insides of covers too. You know, I'm not a collector, so I just scribble on the insides of covers all the time. Take notes.
See, now you're reminded. I didn't have time to go down and pull out the books and get them autographed. I'm going to have to bring them in a suitcase next time you're in New York.
Definitely.
My basement here is cartons and cartons of books.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm
not giving them up. I got my pulps from before my time, and I'm hoping there's going to be print after my time.
I don't know. I mean, when I look at kids, like, you know, I mean, my kid is like, he's reading, he reads, but it's, you know, it's in his profession to read. I mean, he's an architect, and so he reads books on architecture and reads allied stuff. But the kids and this guy I'm staying with in Brooklyn, Mark Jacobson.
He's been on my show.
Yeah.
A great writer.
And he's, his kid, I mean, all he does is play true crime, and it scares me, man. Maybe he'll grow out of
that. See, I think reading is up.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think there are more people reading today than there were 20 years ago.
You may be right. I mean, maybe I'm just looking at I lost my eye a few years ago, and that cut down on my reading quite a bit. And so I started going to the movies, and I was appalled. you know, by how bad the movies were from the movies of the late 70s and the early 80s. Like they just, you know, they lost the Hollywood thing aside. Hollywood, obviously, it took James Bond. The James Bond movies gave Hollywood the template for the die-hard action movie, you know, like the taglines and stuff, and that started dominating for a while, and then it went into what it is now, which is the, you know, basically you're limited to basically farce, half-baked thrillers, you know, like, I mean, they're all done with such low quality, you know, like, with holes in the plots. I mean, just take the science fiction movies that have been made, like, you know, take even the best of them, like, say, Minority Report, which is just has plot holes you could drive a truck through, you know, and like, I mean, it's so sloppy.
It does, but then by that same token, you have a film that tried to be successful, like Sunshine.
Right. But turned into a bad copy of The Event Horizon at the end. You know?
Yeah, it was. I loved the first two-thirds of that film.
Right.
But then, by the same token, you had two good versions of Solaris.
Well, you,
the fact that there was a remake done, which
you like that.
Terrified me. I didn't hate it.
Okay.
I thought ultimately I would say, well, this is not Tarkovsky. It cannot be, and never will be. What's more, it's not Lem.
Right.
And cannot be.
Right. It wasn't Lem.
Yeah, but it was a cerebral science fiction film that
did no business.
That did no business, that's true. Yeah. But it tried. But that's the Soderbergh thing.
Yeah, right.
Talking about the...
Okay, that was the break that I intended to pause at. And too busy doing things online at that moment. But I am here to tell you at this time that you're tuned to listener-sponsored Non-Commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. We are listening to an interview conducted with Lucius Shepard in, you know, I still haven't pinned down the year. I ought to look up. We've heard a few references, what year the movie The Waitress came out, and a few other things that were au courant. It's interesting to note, given our discussion, that self-publishing and all that in Amazon.com and various similar sources had not yet taken full hold the way they have now. But we are talking toward it. And as far as the golden age of independent press is concerned that we were talking about there, we did not foresee, talk about Ellen Datlow's Sci Fiction having been closed down at that point, which is ridiculous. It was closed down the same year that it got more Nebula and Hugo nominations than any other single source, and I think winners for that matter. So it was at its peak, but they just got rid of it. However, today we have Clark's World, we have Lightspeed, and for disclosure, by the way, I am the podcast editor and host of Lightspeed Magazine, at lightspeedmagazine.com, by the way, and many very fine Beneath Ceaseless Skies, many, many fine online professional publications. At the same time, the thing that I was worried about, the emergence of basically unedited fanfic and just unedited fiction. No curator, nobody to say this is good, this is not good, has proliferated a great deal. So, but we hear the roots of it in the conversation with Lucius. Anyway, We're going to take a brief musical break. And since Lucius had a book called Barnacle Bill the Spacer, let's hear an older version, Barnacle Bill the Sailor. This one is Big Spider Beck.
Over the sea.
Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
I'm all lit up like a Christmas tree.
Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
I'll sail the seas until I croak. I'll fight and swear and drink and smoke, but I can't swim a bloody stroke.
Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
Your pies, I'll kiss your cheeks and black your eyes.
Ah, yes. And if you ever get a chance to see the Fleischer cartoon of that same name and background, do so. It's pretty weird. Sort of a prototype Betty Boop in that one. Again, this is Hour of the Wolf. Over WBAI in New York City, this is a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. A reminder that next Tuesday, April 1st, will not be our regular New York Review of Science Fiction readings. We usually do the first Tuesday of every month, but In order to accommodate people's schedules, we are going to be holding the reading, the event, I should say, because it's more than a reading, it's also a panel, on Monday, April 7th. It's a shame that we couldn't do April 1st. It would have been a lark. And the topic, the premise is a tribute to the great, the wonderful Robert Sheckley. And to do that will be with us Alyssa Quitney Sheckley and her mother, Mrs. Sheckley, and the aforementioned Ellen Datlow. And there are a couple of people still in question. Henry Wessels, I'm sorry. And a couple of people still in questions. Among other things, we are going to read / perform a classic Sheckley short story, Warm. And I may very well next week, depending on what else is going on, do a Sheckley show, because you can never lose doing Robert Sheckley on radio. His stuff is just so perfect for the medium. At any rate, it is time to go back to our interview with Lucius Shepard, who passed away last week. And again, I'm guessing that this was approximately the year 2007, possibly 2008. It was certainly on a December 4th. So here we go.
It may not be anything, but it's just a perception. It's just perception, but it seems to me, you know, like, I mean, I don't know, when I do readings, like, not like KGB, but when I do readings out in the hinterlands out on the West Coast and Portland and around in there, like, I don't get as many questions. I get these, I don't know, I'm just getting a feeling that...
Well, you know, you never know. I did a big broadcast that you were almost a part of
right. This
last Friday. And I started out with a 40-year-old radio drama by Samuel R. Delaney.
Right.
As cerebral as you can get, multi-layered, blah, 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 and all that. And when it was all said and done, I opened for phone calls to the great public of New York. This is not KGB or the Nursef readings.
Right,
or,
right.
By the way, that confirms that it's 2007.
That's cool.
Whatever. Who are being exposed to the writing of Samuel R. Delaney for the first time, hopefully, or hearing it again. So I open it to phone calls and, you know, okay, so where are the homophobes and all that? Not one call.
Hmm.
Okay. Later on that night, I played an interview with Jim Kelly, James Patrick Kelly, in which he made some comment about the internet. It was now 3:30 in the morning, what in Arbitron terms they call the death ship. They don't even, our ratings fall within the margin of error.
Right.
At that time, the margin of error is 50,000 people, and we're below that.
Mm-hmm.
At that hour, even in New York. All the phones lit up because he said something about the internet that struck people. Sometimes, now that doesn't mean, later on, I played an interview in what was going to be a live thing with you. I played an older recorded interview with Le Guin, Ursula K. Le Guin. And after that, the phone calls, you could have heard crickets chirping.
And what?
But then one call comes in. And that one person was, well, I'm not sure that in the dispossessed blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And all the phones light up.
Huh.
You just sometimes don't know. Sometimes the more intellectual stuff just doesn't get audience reaction.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that they're not listening.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean they're not with you. It just means that we're not getting feedback. At least I like to tell myself that, or I wouldn't still be doing this
radio. Well, the internet's interesting, you know, like, the internet's really interesting. I mean, you know, like, I'm basically started blogging recently, and, like, you know.
The Gang of Four, right?
Yeah, and, like.
But now, by the way, you're Russian owned. You're aware of this, right?
What?
LiveJournal was sold.
Oh, yeah, right.
To a Russian company, so.
Yeah. So we can't say anything bad about Putin.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
But I mean, you know, it's like I'm, you know, I mean, I wrote in one of my books. I wrote somewhere I can't remember. It was called Floater. I wrote, Internet is the proving ground for the self-esteem of idiots.
And like, oh, I like that.
And like, you know, I mean, on a
as an internet professional, may I say, well put.
Yeah, on a certain level, you know, it's true. But yet. I know for a fact that some of the best film criticism exists on the internet. You know, like, I mean, you know, and I'm talking about guys like Walter Chaw, Film Freak Central, and people like that. And, like, it's some of the best, you know, most
legitimate
insightful criticism going. You know, I think it beats the heck out of the New York Times stuff, you know, and the things that are, you know, like, I mean... Because basically, New York Times has become like another cheerleader.
Well, I like Manola Dargis.
Yeah, I like her too. But A.O. Scott is like, you know,
Tony Scott. Yeah,
yeah. You know, he's basically, he's not what's it, Pauline Kael.
No.
Like,
no, not the same. Not the same. But
or Janet Maslin or any of those others, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Manolo Dargis is pretty good. But
hey, I like Tony Scott.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, you know, I mean, Elvis Mitchell, when he was writing for the New York Times, he called Planet of the Apes, the new version of Planet, a sparkling treat. I can't imagine any circumstance other than, you know, than he was under the influence of
I think something,
you know.
I think Tim Burton would be appalled by that description.
But a treat. I mean, that was probably the stupidest thing.
He'll say that about the next Sweeney Todd.
Yeah, right.
Another Tim Burton movie.
So, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's basically, I mean, most print reviewers I know are compelled to like things, you know. I mean, they are. I mean, I have a friend who writes for a major paper. I know, and I know his opinions of movies that he reviews positively. I mean, you know, and he's gritting his teeth and having to say good things and trying to get in things between the lines, which are really his opinions. But he's compelled to like a certain percentage of what he sees, and he doesn't really, you know, feel that way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know that pressure is on.
Well, I have two things on that. First of all, I had a close friend at WBAI, a fellow named Paul Wunder, whose name was so infamous with being blurbed for bad cinema that Jay Leno took him to task, and that there was an expose of him on 60 Minutes. Paul's not with us anymore, but I did his website, and I've still got it on my computer. And you know, best movie of the year, you know, John Carpenter's best film, blah blah blah, and so on and so forth. I think it was like Gods of Mars or something.
And
Paul really believed that. I mean, he loved that junk, but he had a philosophy, and people would look at his website, which I did, and they wouldn't see us or listen to his radio show and say, well, this guy has never done a bad review. And in his case, that was true. And it wasn't that he got to go to more movie junkets, although it didn't hurt. And he was the junket king. His website is where all the elite that go to the big junkets, they would go there to find out. It's like, oh, yes, the movie Out at Sea is going to be happening on the Queen Mary 2 on its launch, which was true. That's exactly what happened. And so these movie critics, or excuse me, these movie pundits, 20 of them or so were on the launch of the Queen Mary. But his philosophy was an interesting one. It was that his job was to guide people to the movies they wanted to see. Now, I'm a critic. I'm a software and hardware computer critic. I write reviews for national magazines and websites. And I make it a point to say something bad in every review. I don't care how much I love the new toy that I've just played with or something I will come up with, but it doesn't have this or that. But the fact of the matter is that most critics today are compelled. They're climbing on top of each other. They're climbing over each other's skulls. To try to be noticed by the studios, the manufacturers of hardware, in a day in the computer industry where 2 years ago Microsoft was noted for giving away computers to bloggers. Because it had Vista on it. Now, I will be getting a nice computer in here within the week. I will be returning it the week after. That's how it's supposed to work. I keep software. Software I keep. But I think that reviewing in general is dumbed down. So how did you become a reviewer for FNSF?
I just sent Gordon
I should mention, by the way, that I have always in my history at WBAI, I started at WBAI in 1967 as an intern for Baird Searles. And he was the movie critic for, well, it was either Galaxy or FNSF.
Yeah.
He was book critic for one and movie critic for the other.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I just sent Gordon, as a joke, I reviewed this movie X-Men when it came out. And, you know, I just, you know, as a token of friendship, I just sent him this review. I said, this is a review I wrote, and I thought you'd find it amusing, you know. Mm-hmm. It was called Excrement. I deconstructed the film on a lot of levels, you know, and, like, showed how that basically, I mean, the it was a call to cry for conformity, you know, the whole, you know, and thing, this anti-mutant thing and the whole, anyway, it's not worth getting into. But anyway, he liked it, so he printed it, and he said, you want a review for the magazine? And I said, sure, yeah.
How has this changed your life? Because you always were a bit of a Hollywood insider.
Not really. I mean, I just write.
Well, you may not see it that way, but I remember before you were writing for FNSF,
yeah.
When I would see you at a reading, a NIRSF reading, in fact, sometime back when Joe Monti was still running the series.
Right.
You told me about a forthcoming movie called Gattaca.
Yeah, right.
And, which was about a year away from coming out when you told me about it. And boy, did I like that film.
Well, you know, Alex Nicole, who wrote the film, and he later wrote the script. He'd also written the script for The Truman Show.
Right. Which you told me about at the same
which
time.
Was a fantastic script, but it immediately got rewritten. But, that was pretty common knowledge. But, like, I did some work in Hollywood, and, like, you know, I worked on scripts, and I basically did drafts of things, you know, like, which are best forgotten. But, like, the reviewing hasn't changed at all. I mean, it just means now I make a little money for going to the movies. So, you know, it's like, you know. But, and they're not hard to write, you know, because usually, you know, I don't know, usually genre films are not high quality films, you know, like, I mean, they're basically, you know, mass material. I mean, they're just spewed out for, like, the comic book films and things like that. But so we look for films. I try and find films that I like, that I can recommend to people that say, well, you know, you might like the X-Men and stuff like that, but, like, check this out, you know, and stuff. And, like, but it hasn't really changed anything, you know, just, like I said, a little extra income and all that. But, like,
Yeah, but it's made you a pundit. It's made you you have been noticed outside of the genre for what you're writing within a genre magazine. That's pretty
Well, that's probably because of the quality of insult. You know, but anyway, like
The fact that you're not a cheerleader.
No, I'm not a cheerleader.
Nor are you just gainsaying everything for the sake of doing so, which is the other trend that you find.
Yeah, so I don't know. It hasn't really done anything, but I just like movies. I really love movies. I've always, you know, been this, you know, compulsive moviegoer, and so it just gives me an outlet to say things I want to about film.
So why is it that your work is very filmable?
Yeah.
There have been some radio dramas of your work.
Yeah.
But, and being a radio drama chauvinist, I can only cheer. But, of course, the cheering section for radio drama is a very small section indeed, although iTunes is helping that.
Right.
I shouldn't say iTunes. The advent of the podcast is helping that.
So why don't I have movies out of my work?
Yeah.
I mean, basically, I mean, I don't know. I've had, like, a whole lot of things in option, you know, like Life During Wartime was an option for 17 years.
Yeah, I keep hearing, and it moved around, that option.
Oh, yeah, it was James Cameron, you know, Gail Ann Hurd, and Philip Noyce had it for a while, and, like, you know, I mean, went through all the A-list directors pretty much, you know, and they decided it was too expensive a film to make, and too difficult a film to make, so that didn't pan out. Currently, I have a couple of things in option. I have a film that's going to be made later in the year, based on Colonel Rutherford's Colt, which was which is going to be recast and shot in Europe.
Uh-huh.
You know, like the characters are basically a gun dealer and his Indian American Indian wife, and, like, a Native American wife, and, like, so we're taking the story from Washington and Montana around in there and transposing it to Europe. Switzerland, you know, that's being shot by an independent company there, and like
so that may be the best way.
Yeah, so I don't know, but you know, there's currently I have a couple of things in option in Hollywood, but you know the odds of getting a movie made are just so, you know, ridiculously against, you know,
yeah.
Like, you know, that it's like everything gets put into, it gets hot, it gets cold, it gets put in development hell, it just, you know, and so, you know, it just, you know, you never know, you know, but, you know, the option money's all right, you know, so.
If you had your choice, budget aside, reality aside, mm-hmm. what would you want to see dramatized in what medium and how? Just dream talking.
You know, I really don't think about that a whole lot. I mean, you know, like, I mean, I've always taken the William Goldman approach to Hollywood. If they throw money at you, take it and run the other way.
Uh-huh.
You know, and like, but I mean, I mean, ideally, you know, I'm real happy with this Colonel Rutherford's Cult thing, because it's
actually, it sounds like it has potential.
It's a cool story, and it's like, and it's perfect for a low budget indie kind of, you know, production, and like, you know, so I just assume, you know, Life During Wartime would have been a very expensive film. I've seen the screenplays.
Yeah.
You know, for Life During Wartime, and they took Mengele, the protagonist of the book, mm-hmm. who's an 19-year-old soldier, and they turned him into a 35-year-old top sergeant. You know, and so I asked my agent about this, and my old Hollywood film agent, and Patricia Carlin, and she said, just be thankful that you didn't turn him into a 58-year-old black grandmother, you know, like, you know, so, I mean, you know, that was their opinion. Yeah, that was their...
It would have been harder to cast, though,
yeah,
by the star.
Right, you know, I mean, but, I mean, so basically when you're talking about a Hollywood movie, I mean, they're going to do what they want with it, you know, I mean, for instance, like, I mean, we're talking about Mark Jacobson, I mean, Mark's article on Frank Lucas was recently made into a film called American Gangster.
Right.
You know, and it had really little to do with the basic truth of the situation. You know, like, I mean, Frank Lucas was a mean, nasty guy, you know, basically. And, like, I guess that's opinion, but that, you know,
yeah.
But
that's always the case.
But I mean they
Elliot Ness was not a nice guy.
And
look at how many times he's been hero worshipped.
And Richard Roberts, the Russell Crowe character, I mean, really didn't interact with Denzel at all, with Frank Lucas at all, of the way he did with Denzel. I mean, and Denzel didn't have all these human qualities, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you know, like, I mean, so it just totally turned around, and they left out most of the good stuff, you know. Mm. Like, you know, but I mean, you just basically take the money and are glad, you know. Like,
yeah.
But
I suppose I should ask Mark, but did he like the film?
Never mind.
Okay. Next question.
Yeah, but I mean, basically, I think, you know, the more money you give a director, the worse film you're going to get.
Mm.
You know, I mean, basically, it's like.
I agree with that.
The less important story becomes, the more production values become important. The more, you know, special effects and all this stuff. And I think really.
Well, so how about radio drama? The BBC did a fairly nice job, actually.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean,
I know it doesn't have the reach, at least in this.
Yeah.
Country, and even although BBC is not ignored in England,
no.
Even their radio drama and Radio
right.
4 and all that
no,
has worldwide reach with the internet, is how I got it.
Right. But I don't know, I just like to have a movie or two, and like the small movies
yeah.
seem to me the way to go, because the reason they're making the film is because the story interests them, not because, I mean, with the with Life During Wartime, the one scene they all talked about was the fight between the man and the jaguar in the pit, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, and like they all talked about these big set pieces like that, you know, filming these big set pieces. The basic story and the idea of the vast Central American conspiracy and like all this stuff, it just went away, you know,
yeah.
like, and so they just became interested in making this compilation of set pieces, you know, and like, you know, the smaller films with less money, they're interested, like I said, in your story.
Yeah.
And like, and the characters. And so, you know, that seems to me that the most an author can hope for is that some small, talented film company, you know, with talent and enough cash to make a movie at their disposal, within a budget of $1 or 2 million.
Yeah. You know. Let's get to your writing, to your books.
Sure.
You mentioned all these things that you are working on at once, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm working on... I mean, you know, you have days like, you know, when you don't feel like working on the book and on the novel, and then... So I've got a whole bunch of other projects that I just, you know, I go to in that case. And then I, you know, a lot of times I work on the novel in the morning, and then I eat lunch or something, or, you know, go for a walk, and then I come back and I work on something else, you know, like a, you know.
Short story, a sorbet.
A short novel, like, you know, Halloween, I this thing I read at the KGB, Halloween story, the Halloween Town. It just, you know, occurred to me one day to write, and like it just writes itself, you know. Now whenever I have a few minutes, you know, I turn around and just type a few lines of that, you know, and like so gradually it's accreting to it where it's now about, you know, 40,000 words, you know, and like and like it'll probably end up about 60 or 70, a small novel, but like but basically it's just a really, it's something, you know, it's one of those gift stories that you've always had and you kind of, you feel like in there, it just wants to come out, you know. So there's plenty of things like that that are, writing the novel is for me very hard. It's a difficult process, but there are a lot of other things that are relatively easy, and, you know, so I just go to them.
What kind of techniques do you use when you find that something is hard going, like a novel? Do you make notes? Do you force yourself to work on something every day in the Samuel Johnson method?
Oh, yeah, I work on something every day, you know, pretty much. I mean, not on this trip, you know, but like, but when I'm at home, I work every day, and I usually work pretty long hours, you know, like 8 or 9 hours a day, you know, like, and sometimes as many as 14, you know, like 14 or 15 hours, but mostly... I try to maintain it at 8 hours or so, you know, around in there, and like, you know, I like work, you know, and so, you know, it's I have to, you know, kind of hold myself back, you know, from doing too much, you know, but there's a tendency, you know, like to use short stories as a break from a novel and stuff like that, you know, you know, and so, you know.
Now, are those easier for you to write, or is it just that they come to a conclusion earlier?
No, it's not. It depends on the materials, totally, you know, like, I mean, you know, like...
I know some people, like Terry Bisson, can, like, toss off a short story in a couple of hours.
Well, actually, short stories are very hard for me.
But short stories are very difficult for many people.
The form I like to... like best is like between 25,000 and 40,000-50,000 words, you know, like, which is a short novel or a novella, and like and so I've always got several of those going. I mean, I've probably got like 5 or 6 of those right now that are cooking, you know.
That's a form that doesn't really flourish too well outside of science fiction, does it?
Well, yeah, it does, you know. I mean,
That length.
I mean, you know, for instance, Stuart Onan's last book was the thing he wrote with King was a shortish book, and this book he's got now about a Requiem for the Last Night at Lobster or whatever.
Oh, I don't know.
It's about the last night of a Red Lobster restaurant in some part of New England. It's only 140 pages. You know? Most of my books are longer than that. You know,
yeah,
I mean, most of my short novels are longer than that. Are usually 180, 170 pages. You know, and so it's. I mean, I think somebody told me once, and I don't know how true this is, that books are that a book like The Notebook or a book like there's certain these small sort of slim volume things.
The chapbooks, yeah.
I mean, no, like they really get to be bestsellers, you know, like Bridges of Madison County is a classic.
Okay.
I mean, like which is I don't know, probably about 50,000 words.
See, I guess I hadn't really been paying attention in that way.
The Great Gatsby.
But that was different.
About 50. Well, yeah, but yeah. It was different than Bridges of Madison County for sure. But
yeah.
But basically, it was the same form.
Marketing as well.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a tried and true, you know, kind of length, you know, for a novel. I mean, you know, like that, and many of them become pretty good sellers. You know, they write more commercially, say, than I do. You know, like, I mean, the guy who wrote The Notebook and things like that. You know, but I mean, basically, I mean, they can become big sellers. You know, it's not a matter of length. It's like, you know, people like very short, slim books, or they like big beach books. You know, and so, you know, so in a vampire, I'm trying to do a big beach book. You know, like, you know, so, you know,
that's got a lot of potential. Is that why people have problems with the short stories, and does that in turn relate to the paucity of the paucity isn't the word, but the problems that the digests may be facing?
I don't know. I think there are a lot of really good short story writers out now, especially in the genre. You know,
I know there's great short story writers out there.
Ford and Rickert and people like that. You know, I mean, you know, it's like...
It's hard to make a living at.
Yeah, it is. Like, I mean, you know, but then you had, you know, I mean, going back to Harlan and all these people, like, I mean, you know, they did pretty well, you know, so, I mean...
Now, did Harlan make a living writing short stories stolen?
I think he did for a while, but, I mean, you know, like, anyway, yeah. But, you know, like, I wonder if he's got a piece of the new TV show. The Terminator is a TV show now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I would assume that he has. Yeah. And latest word is that when J.J. Abrams said that they were going to use the Guardian of Time to bring Spock back into the past,
right.
Ellison said, not without paying me, you're not.
Right.
So.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, he's on top of that stuff more than I am, but like...
It's a living.
Yeah, but short stories, just for me, I mean, it's really, you know, I mean, I'm not a minimalist writer, and so most of the ideas I have take a certain length to flesh out. You know, I use a lot of descriptive prose and stuff like that, but you know, I've published a couple of short stories recently that are... I sold a couple to Playboy, and I sold...
Playboy pays.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
They, for years, they were the only market that paid for a short story. When the digests were paying 3 cents a word, right. Playboy was paying 25 cents a word.
Playboy plays, you know, a lot.
You know? Yeah, like, I'm talking 40 years ago.
Yeah, and like you know, I published a couple... I've had a couple of relatively short pieces lately, but I mean, it's just like, you know, what the story demands. I mean, some stories just tell themselves in 6,000 words, and others, you know, seem to take longer, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
so. Well, you're lucky in that you can, well, not lucky, because the luck is something that's evolved over 25 years.
Right.
But you are now fortunate, let me put it that way, in that you are at a place where you can say, this is what the story is. I don't have to worry as much about the market.
Right, yeah.
And just see where this will fit.
Yeah, and that's about the virtue of the small press. I mean, you can always find someone to make a little book of it. You know, if you can't find a big press to do it, you can always find somebody like Nightshade or, you know, some small...
P.S. Publishing.
Yeah, P.S.
They're Golden Griffin. There are a few people out there who are actually astonishingly... running presses with the idea that the short story is a great form.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And not just anthologies, but collections.
Yeah. But I think in the mainstream, or whatever that's called nowadays, like, I mean, you know, general fiction, you find the short novel prospering more than you even do in science fiction, at least prospering for the author. You know, that authors can sell these books for some serious money, you know, like, and so, you know, that works for them. I mean, I'm sure, like, the lobster thing I mentioned by Onan, you know, that was a Farrar Straus book, I think, or I don't know, Viking, maybe, you know, and like, and so, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm sure he did pretty well with that, you know, it's gotten good reviews, and like, you know, so it's, you know, that's heartening, you know, it's good.
Is your fiction where you want it to be?
You mean, is it as good as I want it to be?
Yeah.
No. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think anybody ever feels that way who cares about their fiction. I mean, you know, like, I think I'm writing better.
It was a trick question, of course. But.
Better than I was, like, you know, when I first started. But, like, you know, I always want to do better. You know, like, you know, I see a gradual improvement, you know, so.
How's the marketing? I mean, you have become one of the best respected names, at least in terms of literary speculative fiction. People know who you are. They don't necessarily relegate you to that one pit of science fiction, the Jaguar Hunter, as a book could be found in bookstore windows.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's the marketing. I don't know, you know. I mean,
oh, that was a few years ago, but it's still a great book, you know, great collection.
No, I mean, you know, it's all right, you know, like, I mean, I sell better overseas, actually, than I do here, you know, and, like, you know, that's perhaps my fault, you know, as much as anybody's fault. Like, you know, I haven't really tried, I haven't been actively trying to become a
marketer?
A marketer, or at least, like, to write something that, you know, that the big publishing house would be interested in, you know, lately.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's simply a matter of disposition. And when I came up with the idea for this novel I'm working on now, I mean, I said, well, that's one that I could do with a major house, you know, like, you know, that has enough hooks and enough, you know, enough teen appeal to, you know, like, you know, to float, you know. So, I mean, but, you know, like, for instance, Viator, a short novel I wrote a few years ago, which is about six homeless men who are sent to do salvage on a freighter that's been shipwrecked on the coast of Alaska. I mean, that really very few, I mean, it's all written in very long sentences, you know, some several pages in length, you know, and it was an experiment in form as well as in subject matter, and it didn't really sing to the large companies. I mean, it didn't say, wow, well, here we've got a science fiction, a Faulknerian science fiction. Like, wow, that's something we really want, you know? Like,
yeah, but on the other hand, I can see where the collections, the retrospectives of your work are going to love that.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, yeah. That's, you know, I have one coming out next year, as a matter of fact.
Exactly.
But, you know, like the, yeah, no, I mean, that'll be good. I mean, you know, like, I mean, because they'll get to collect all those short novels together and, you know, and all that stuff. And then that'll be nice, you know. But, you know, it's, I don't think it's the smartest way to conduct a career, you know, like, you know. But, you know, I'm trying at this late date to turn that around by doing a couple of larger books, you know, that are gonna, you know, so.
Any franchises in your future?
No.
No bubblegum cards?
No, I seriously doubt it, you know, like, I mean, the vampire novel is probably the closest I'm ever going to come to that, you know. I mean, there might be a sequel in that, but I don't know. You know,
hey, I could see that as a shared universe game. People log in online.
Just as long as you don't call it a standalone novel. I mean, that's like, you know.
Yeah, right.
That's sort of a horrid term. I mean, it's hard for me to think of like Ulysses as being a standalone. I mean, you know, but anyway.
And the question is, which Ulysses was Lucius referring to there? You know, was he referring to Joyce? Or was he... I think he was referring to the James Joyce is what he was doing, not the Homer. But you've been listening to an interview with Lucius Shepard conducted December 4th, 2007. I'm pretty sure because I made mention of... the Star Pit anniversary there, and the Star Pit 40th anniversary. It was 40th anniversary was then. It was in May, June 1967 when I first began working at WBAI. That Samuel R. Delaney was doing the Star Pit. So this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. If you care to write me, it's jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com. You can also friend me or find me on Facebook, but I really, really don't care. for Facebook mail, I must say. Send me a normal email instead. I far, far prefer it. And otherwise, next week on this program, I haven't quite decided. Could be a Robert Checkley show. Could be that I'll I'm interviewing Nalo Hopkinson this Friday. With any luck, we'll be hearing that. And, well, there's all kinds of possibilities. Also, Marco Adler's new book, Vampires R Us, is out, and high time that she meets these airwaves again. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way in just 3 minutes. Again, thanks for listening, and everybody, be wonderful to each other. Good morning.
I am as a tall sailing ship out on the sea.
I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Me say you get dizzy and you faint in the past. Cause dirty nigga come and them a pass them remorse. And rolling stone said the gathers no mass. Say fan fi me foot me angle wear fi me clogs. A costume ball you better put on your mask. Me love fi drink me milk butter strictly out of glass. So my mask like snake air in a grass. But a rolling stone said the gather no mass. a rolling stone. It gather no mass. Me better than the DJ Lord Sassafras. Every night in my dance, in my DJ both ass. But this a DJ, say you know him a the boss. Hey, cause this a DJ in a top of Norris class. A rolling stone, say it gathers no malas. A rolling stone, say it gather no mass. Hey, chum is a Irie, miss a Irie, make your bad so. Chum is a Irie, miss a Irie, make your guan so. Chum is a Irie, miss a Irie, make your bad so. Right about now, some call it so. Say me on my way to Toronto. Say in a aeroplane, it was a jumbo. Me sit down by the seat and look through the window. But little after that, me say me sight Ringo. Him say, hey, wait an Irie, we make your bad so. Cause rings by your finger, bells by your toe. Say when you DJ, your sound just like Sparrow. And when you are dancing, it's just like Lala Rope. On the aeroplane wing, me see a John Crow. And wing pan it, if him say that him a Kimbo. Him mouth it shape like he was saying hello. Chum, Mr. Irie, make your bad so. Chum, Mr. Irie, make your guan so. Chum, Mr. Irie. I run a little in stud alone, said this gather is none of no mala loss. I run a little in stud alone, it gather no moss. You shouldn't leave your yard and not eat breakfast. Me say you feel bad and then you fainting at the pass. Conduct the nigga come and them up, ask them remorse. But from my feet, me hunger, wear up me clocks. Me go to costume mall, me up in your mask. And some of them sneaking like snakes in a grass.
And when you get me to the street, no chat. Sometimes some back and some of them are rally back. But we a road boy, you and we no take back no chat. You full of big chat and can't defend that. If a jailhouse you come from, we sending you go back. You full of big chat and can't defend that. If a Bellevue you come from, we sending you go back. Cause with them there you when they get a run hot. When we look in the food for the pot. Man of him 16 over him back. 45 and we have a rampart. Care bazooka and all if he glock. When we move in, we move compact. A man we take a couple store, couple bank and shop. And police man a talk about we hot. Judge I know we have to run left this part. Danda yati, dog at sedat. When we come dance, all of a block. Me say some a rally back and some of them dance back. We a road boy out and we not left a glock. And some a rally back and some of them dance back. When they killing at the place and the place of a block. With them there when Kingston run hot. When we look in the food for we pot. Kingston with there when my sub get shot. Kingston with there when Kappa get shot. Kingston with there when a bird get shot. Man a Kingston with there when a cow get shot. Sandakan when him lick down flat. Natty Morgan lick down flat. Jungle man Spanglery my man did hot. And the uptown man them did hot. And the Riverton man them run hot. Firehouse mall road did hot. And the Pinland man them hot. And Backbush man them did hot. Warrika Hill man them running hot. Nannyville man them did hot. Me say some a rally back and some of them dance so back. Them a road boy out way a bus off the clock. Some a rally back and some of them dance so back. Me say some of them a fryers and some of them a nuts. Full of pose and enough big chatter. When you buck them can't defend that. Running off them mouth non-stop. Buck them half up the 16 and Glock. And me shot him a cotton boxer. And the boy start run non-stop. Miss a cat on the mic and a chatter. And police come in a jeep back. And them coming from Amman Barracks. And them coming and coming non-stop. And the road boy them firing shot. Busting the shot them bust it non-stop. Make me tell you them deaf on the attacker. Miss a cat round the mic and a chat. Miss a summer rally back and some of them dance back. We a road boy out and we not left a clap. Summer rally back and some of them dance back. We a road boy out, we not take no back chat. With them there when Kingston run out. When we look in the food for the pot. And guarding poor people and top. When the politics fliction drop. When the bomber drop on house top. And every morning a dead man and spotter. And the youth them go school show shatter. Make me tell you them bend down flatter. And school book man it deaf on them backer.